Your call is now live.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Rural Routes for Change webinar offered by Praxis International and the Office on Violence Against Women. RRCs are intended to strengthen interagency responses to battering. I'm Ashley Tilley, and I'll be your tech support for the session. Today's topic is calling victims before they call you. I'm joined by Rose Thielen, our technical assistance partner on Rural Coordinated Community Response and regular host of these webinars. Hi, Rose, and welcome. In addition to Rose, we're fortunate to be joined by Kathleen Marvin from Tillamook County Women's Resource Center and Stephanie Avalon from Battered Women's Justice Project as our guests. Rose, I'll ask you to further introduce our speakers in just a moment, but would like to first cover a few webinar logistics. RRCs are intended to be an informational dialogue rather than training, and we rely on your input to our speakers' conversation. I do have a few webinar tips. If you're using audio only and you have any email comments, feel free to email them to me at ashley@praxisinternational.org. If you're using a computer, feel free to use our chat feature to chat with the general public as well as our private tab to chat with the speakers on the call today or to report technical problems to myself. If you do lose webinar or phone connection, you can use the initial join link from the email, or you can also email me for help. You can also just dial back in to the code that I'll post on the chat. The session is also recorded, and that will be available in a few days on the website, and I'll post that link as well. All right, Rose, take it away.
Thank you, Ashley. Good job. This is Ashley's first time doing this. She's filling in for Liz, who's on vacation. And as Ashley said, this conversation today is about contacting victims before they call you. We're specifically talking about something that's come to be known as the advocacy-initiated response. And we're going to spend this next hour and 15 minutes talking with Stephanie Avalon, my good friend of many years and colleague. She and I both started out in the battered women's movement as advocates, and then we got involved in something that was like the CCRs, where we were involved in trying to reform the criminal justice system response. And in that capacity, we were involved and fully engaged in contacting women as soon as possible after an arrest. So she comes to it from the experience of doing it, as well as now she's what we call a resource specialist, although she is an advocate and always will consider herself such at heart. And she works for the Battered Women's Justice Project, so has lots of valuable information about the practice. So welcome, Stephanie. I'm so happy that you could join us.
Thank you, Rose.
And then we also have with us Kathleen Marvin, who is a colleague out in Tillamook County, city in Oregon, and she is coming to us as somebody who is currently engaged in...
Excuse me, Rose.
Yes?
They're having, in the chat, it looks like they're having a bit of problem hearing you. Is there any way you can turn the volume up on your phone, maybe?
Oh, no, there sure isn't. Let me get another phone, though. Maybe I've got a...
Yeah, I think they're having trouble hearing you, so we should...
Oh, bummer. All right, hang on. How's this?
Let's try that, yep.
Okay, all right.
Sorry about that interruption.
Yeah, that's quite all right. So I suppose I should start over again, and I'll make it a little briefer, but we have Stephanie Avalon with us today, and we're going to be discussing the practice called advocacy-initiated response, which is something that advocacy programs do in terms of contacting victims before they contact us. And as I mentioned, Stephanie is a longtime colleague and friend. She and I started out working I was the late 70s, she was the early 80s, and we were advocates, and then we contacted victims as a part of our criminal justice reform efforts. And so we both had experience doing this. And now Stephanie is a resource specialist at the Battered Women's Justice Project, a national resource center but continues to consider herself an advocate at heart, as do I. And we also have with us Kathleen Marvin from Tillamook County, Oregon, and she is an executive director of a program where they are just beginning the process of negotiating with law enforcement and others in the community to establish this practice. So we have a breadth of experience in terms of this particular practice, and I want to check whether you can hear me. Ashley, do you know? Yes? I'm just going to assume you can hear me. Sorry for the technical difficulties.
Most are saying...
What? Jeez. Hello? Anybody there?
I can hear you, Rose.
You can hear me. Okay, I can't hear Ashley. So, all right, good. Thank you. Let me know if you can hear me. All right, and I'm speaking loudly. If I start talking too loud, let me know that as well. Okay, so without any further ado, and again, sorry for the disruption in terms of being able to get the technology straight here. We have a number of people who have phoned in today. We had about 91 registrants and 44 people on the line, mostly domestic and violence and sexual assault programs, some of them dual, some of them independent. And so let's start out, however. Wanted to find out from you whether, in fact, how many of you work in communities that provide an advocacy-initiated response. And you can answer this question by, Ashley, are you available there? This is a poll, so you can put up a yes. B would be no, and three is don't know, and then we'll get some sort of poll. And, of course, what we're talking about when we say don't know is you don't know whether you're doing it, that would be a don't know, or you don't know what the response is, either way. We're particularly interested in those who might be currently providing it. And, you know, I guess we're interested in all those variables there. Okay, looks like 33% are doing it, 30% aren't, and 5% don't know. So that's good. Thank you. I don't see the little pie chart, but we'll keep moving here. All right, so let's get started. Stephanie, a little rough introduction there, but welcome, and if you want to say a few intro comments, feel free to do so. But we're going to start out with, if you could talk with us about what is this advocate-initiated response?
Okay. Well, first of all, we'll talk about what it isn't. I mean, it really departs from a typical shelter response, which would be to wait for victims to contact them. And that actually developed out of, policies developed around this early on in the shelter movement because advocates were aware that there were a lot of potential problems associated with labeling women as battered. And sometimes people would contact shelters and tell them about a battered woman they thought the shelter should contact and respond. The policy established was that they would say, have her call us. And so that meant that you weren't calling somebody and, they weren't getting a cold call from a shelter and discovering that somebody thought they were battered and needed help, which could be kind of embarrassing. And the other thing that it avoided was calling at a time when the abuser might be home. But then, of course, once law enforcement got involved in the situation, the information is public, not private. So what the advocate-initiated response is a way of contacting victims when there's been law enforcement involvement. And in order to do that, you have to have the cops informing the advocate that there's a victim whose partner has been arrested. And there are various ways of making that connection. And then the advocate contacts the victim. Usually they get at least a summary of what's gone on. In programs I worked for, we actually had the police reports, which was very, very helpful.
Now, Stephanie, I think this is obviously this is the critical piece, because often we hear people say, well, yeah, we do advocate-initiated response. We will do advocacy for women after there's an arrest and we're contacted by law enforcement. But this one suggests that they contact, that the contact is made by law enforcement to the advocacy program, and it's not discussed with the victim. Is that right?
That's right. I mean, it's. I mean, the cop might say an advocate is going to call you.
Right, right.
They don't. You know, they don't. They're not saying. They're not asking the victim, do you want an advocate to call you?
Right, right. So, and I think that's a crucial piece, because, and we'll get into that as we go on in this conversation, but, you know, we've done these types of questions, these similar sorts of discussions before, and people think they're doing it because they're available to provide advocacy, but it's not something that happens routinely every time there's an arrest. So I just wanted to make that particular point at this particular juncture. So, you know, what we generally see now is what's up on the slide, right? And Kathleen, now you're in a program in Oregon, and your current practice is what's up there on the webinar slide. Do you want to talk some about that?
Yes, I would love to talk about that. Well, what we find is that we have several departments in our jurisdiction, in our county, and what happens during a law enforcement response is inconsistent across departments and among between officers. So some are offering information about our program or the court-based victims program. Others do not. Some will call us out and some will not. So it's been a very inconsistent and unpredictable response.
So it's usually up to the discretion of the officer, or whether the officer thinks it's a good idea, or if they ask the victims and the victims say, yes, I'd like you to contact them, or sometimes the officer just says, I recommend that you contact the victim, right?
All those things happen, yes.
Yeah, yeah. And so, of course, the result is what? I mean, this is true in your community, right?
So what we find out is that very few people will call us, at least not right away, and they may become, you know, engaged in systems in ways that are not really helpful to them as a result, and then end up calling us later when we might have been able to help support them through, you know, preventing some of that.
Right.
I want to respond to Laura's question, whether law enforcement, she's asking in the chat, whether does law enforcement ask for a phone number at a time that is safe? And, of course, law enforcement, of course, is gathering, you know, the victim's phone number, and if they're doing a really good job, they're also finding out another phone number where she could be reached, you know, like maybe her mother's number or some other good number. And the issue of safety is not really relevant when the abuser's been arrested and taken away. You know, mm-hmm. So there's not a concern that the assailant is going to be listening in on her conversation with an advocate or talking to her about why are you talking to that advocate. And, in fact, even if they do find out, I mean, when you're initiating a call, you explain that it's because the police contacted you as an advocacy agency. This is a policy. and it happens with everybody.
Right.
Every time there's a domestic violence arrest, the advocacy agency is called, and we contact the victim.
Right.
And in all the times I've made these calls, I've never had a victim be indignant or angry that the call was made. In fact, the usual response is, yes, I understand why you'd have a policy like that. That's really good. You know, they might say, but I don't need the call. but
right.
Nobody's ever angry or upset that there's such a policy that's established this routine reaching out.
Yeah, and we'll get into some of those nuts and bolts as we go on, but I think you make some very important points, and part of what you have to do when you're negotiating this as a community advocacy program is that the defendant will be held in jail for a period of time. And, you know, some of that you may run into some difficulties with your statute or how bail is done or how releases are done in your community. And we'll get into some of that later. I was just out to Tillamook, and we were working on this with the law enforcement and prosecutor's office, and that's an obstacle right there. But like I say, I think we can get to that as we go. I mean, I think for now, why do women say no when they're asked if they want an advocate to contact them? If they're saying yes, when the advocate contacts them without being asked to, why would they say no if they're asked? I mean, this is a kind of a confusing slide, but what it means is that generally when officers ask victims, do you want us to contact the advocacy program on your behalf, they'll say no, right?
And we have a chat-in response here from Erica, who says they might not know what an advocate does, and that is absolutely right on, Erica, because as an advocate taking calls at the Battered Women's Justice Project, I can't tell you how many times I've had to explain what an advocate does. Most people out there don't understand it. They don't know why, so if you're going to refer somebody to an advocate, you kind of have to say, this is what they're going to do. This is what they can do for you, and this is what you can ask them about, and this is what they should know about. But just in general, they have no reason to believe that. But it gets even more, they also don't think they're battered women. I mean, their partners can get arrested for an assault that doesn't put them in the hospital or leave them bruised from head to toe. And a lot of women don't think they qualify for the term battered because they don't think they look as bruised up as Farrah Fawcett in The Burning Bed.
Right, right. And Kathleen, is that true for you? Do you know why victims would say no to something like that? In addition to, I mean, Stephanie, you mentioned first they don't know what an advocate is, and secondly, they may not think they qualify as somebody who needs your services if they do. Some women think, I only need an advocacy program if I'm prepared to leave him, and I'm not going to leave, right? But other reasons? And feel free to chat them in, too.
Sure, and that's actually what I was going to speak on, was that victims, survivors, often, in our experience, when we have served them, have said they've hesitated to come because it was their belief that we would be wanting them to take certain steps, or that they would automatically have to work with other systems that maybe they don't want to work with. So that's just the misunderstanding of what an advocate does, and also that. And feeling shame, taking on responsibility for what happened can be a real factor in that, being overwhelmed with so many things she's facing.
Easily have a million things they have to do. They're trying to figure out who's going to take care of the kids when they go to work now that their partner's been taken off to jail and they don't know for how long. I mean, they might be busy talking to family members. I mean, women are busy in these situations. They could be, and they could be needing medical care.
Right.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, there's a, you know, in the conversations that have held, been held with women in focus groups and, you know, in the recent research that was done in Denver, women came up with, had a lot of reasons why they didn't call, and then a lot of, and a lot of reasons why when they were called, they wanted to talk to that advocate. So, I mean, that's why there is this renewed focus on advocacy initiated response, that, that it's a, what we hear from victims is that there's a huge need for them to get this information and, you know, support. And, you know, the guy leaves in the car with the officer and then all of a sudden there they sit and go, well, what's next? What did the officer say about him getting out? Do I have to go to court? Am I going to be able to see him again? And those are the very things that that call coming from the advocacy program can be a lifesaver. So, so Stephanie, you've been working in the Battered Women's Justice Project and working with a number of programs around the country who are doing this practice again. Do you, would you, could you add some stuff here about the reasons that you know of?
Sure. Sure. I think one of the major reasons is the increased use of lethality assessments like the Maryland lethality assessment. In fact, one of our participants had already chatted in Bismarck. They use the Maryland lethality model, she says, and so the and the whole point of that. Of that model, and by the way, it can be, we have a whole lot of information on it on our Promising Practices webpage. And so if people want to learn more about the Maryland Lethality Assessment, that's a nice starting place. But what it basically was designed to do was to connect victims to advocates, because in Jackie Campbell's research, over the years with the danger assessment and looking at women who are killed, it was noted more than once that women who were killed were not likely to have been connected to advocacy programs. So it's a big protective factor if women have sought services. And so her danger assessment was redesigned as a tool for law enforcement to determine dangerousness or lethality risk. It's not, it reduced the questions from 20 down to about 11 questions. And the they immediately connect women who are high risk to advocates that are they're on call. And I think the protocol is that they are connecting them literally from the cop calling from the scene and then handing the phone to the woman. And that whole point of it, the whole point of that is making this advocacy connection, which is really great. And we've talked to some programs that have that had never done an advocate-initiated response before. And they're not just calling the women who are high risk. They're calling all of them because they now have this information. And so they're able to do it. And what they've discovered is that there's been, like, between 40 and 60% increases in the use of their services.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So it is meeting a need.
And hopefully it will translate into more, you know, fewer women having being murdered. I mean, if the lethality, I mean, we can't claim that advocacy will prevent the homicide, but we also know that the resources that she needs in order to escape a very dangerous person is exactly what the advocacy program can provide to her. But yeah, that's a very good assessment to look at. And Stephanie, Kathleen. Yeah. Anything to add about that? I mean, you're not looking at the Maryland assessment as much as you're looking at you asking those questions that are part of the blueprint, the risk questions, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, yes. Those are more open-ended. So those, you know, so there's some options out there. In some places, the Maryland assessment has been critiqued because it's a yes-no checklist, and it gets less into this conversation and this capacity to have this engage the victim in talking about her life. And I know, Stephanie, you've been aware of that critique as well, but whatever you do, I think the point is that this is a very critical component to look at in terms of doing your CCR. And there was recently a study, I know that Stephanie on the Battered Women's Justice Project, and we had her on our Rural Routes to Change as well, the authors from this 2012 study of advocacy-initiated response are pretty much the science that says, okay, this works, let's do this. So tell us some about what you know here, Stephanie, about this research.
Okay. Again, this is a promising practice that was posted on our website last year. It's still up, describing how the city of Denver, Colorado, responds to domestic violence. And they started their project called the Triage Project back in 2006, and it involves a collaborative, multidisciplinary team that seeks to identify and assess risk factors for ongoing severe domestic violence, and it provides active and immediate outreach to support victims and achieve rapid containment of the offenders. So they use outreach by community-based advocates who initiate contact, and that ensures that the domestic violence victims receive all the information on protection orders, safety planning, and so forth, really within a very short time of the incident. And the study that was done was an NIJ study directed by Anne DePrince at the University of Denver, and it showed that early victim-focused contact promotes engagement with the criminal justice system by increasing the likelihood that victims are invited to participate actively in their cases by system professionals and the likelihood that women will go to court. And it also shows that in the study that women perceived that they had benefited from this outreach. Because a lot of folks had been concerned that it would seem intrusive to initiate this kind of contact, and in contrast to that worry or concern, the study actually showed that women had less stress in their lives and felt like they benefited from the contact. So it completely disproved any concerns that this would be disempowering to women. Quite the contrary.
Yeah, and you know, I think it's important here because what was done was that the victim witness advocates did one of two things. Either they told the victims about the community-based advocacy program and encouraged them to call, or they told the victims that the advocacy program would be calling them. And this is the victim witness people. And what they discovered was that the women who did contact, I mean, the women who were contacted by the advocate, that the contact was initiated by the advocate, that they showed this increased well-being, reduced psychological distress, and they actually showed better outcomes. And they thought, in looking at it, they thought the biggest piece was in terms of, in addition to the fact that they were contacted instead of making the call themselves, was this whole idea that they had a confidential advocate. And so it shows the value of that because, you know, Kathleen, you go back to this, you mentioned this piece about being ashamed. Well, you know, this is a person who's going to contact her, and anything that's said to her is not going to go anywhere. It's confidential. And that made a big difference to the women involved. And it's interesting in this particular study, too, and I encourage everybody to look at it, but the women of color, the impact, the positive effects were more pronounced for women of color communities when they were contacted by an advocacy program than for white women. But all across the board, regardless of race, creed, ethnicity, et cetera, there was this profound and pronounced impact. And so it's it's pretty much what I'm using a lot of times to support the need to do this. And so, you know, when we started working to reform the criminal justice system so many years ago, this was, like we mentioned before, a traditional part of what was done. The advocates, it was assumed they would be going out and calling the victims, going to their homes in some cases, but they'd be making that effort. And then over time, it's not happening. And we see that programs are somewhat hesitant to do so. And so if you're a community who has been thinking about this or wondering about this, do you have any reasons that you might put forward here in the chat about what makes you hesitant to use this intervention? That would be useful in terms of discussing this at this particular point. Maybe it's not a deal. I know in my conversations with people at the various institutes and conferences we hold, we hear a number of things, and so I think it's really something to talk about as a movement or a community of advocates to think these things through. So, if you got anything to say here.
Oh, Laura says, huh? I see we have Laura responding that staff capacity is one issue. And I worked in a program that was very, very short-staffed, and the advocate-initiated response was actually done by volunteers.
Right,
and that solved that problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we had formerly battered women who would make that call. We'd give them, like, I think it wasn't probably enough money, but I think $30 a time when they got a call. And so, and it was an easy, in our community, it was easy to raise that kind of money from a church. You know, we've got, at that time, we didn't have many arrests in a year, so we said about 60 arrests a year. We need about $30 per arrest. Can you give us, what is it, $1,800 or something? So there's ways of doing it, and then, of course, that takes care of the initial contact, but there is the advocacy that happens the next day as well, because it isn't, as you know, just a one-shot deal where you contact them and then you don't have contact with them again, but that you will hear that now and then, but I think that's where it becomes particularly important to look at how you distribute your resources. Kathleen, do you have anything to say as a person who's working in a program right now? I know you've got resource issues. How do you land on that particular issue? Did you restructure? Did you reorganize? Are you thinking about taking time from somebody else and what do you think about that?
We actually have started working on some of that, and we're building our our hotline capacity, our volunteers, and we have a really good relationship with our court-based program. So we're defining roles and creating lists of the information that will be provided. But I think for our program, one of the biggest barriers was that fear of potentially causing harm somehow by calling or intruding into a person's life. So that was a long time history that our program had been handed down since we were founded, was just that we don't go where we're not invited kind of thinking. And those fears have been alleviated the more, with the conversations about people don't need to talk to us if we call. I mean, they're given that opportunity. But the resource question, we, after having some meetings with partners and volunteers, and then we're in a real community as well, so we really took a look at how many calls this would mean for our project, for our program, and realized it seemed very overwhelming at the beginning to think about it, but it's much less so.
Okay.
We've had some really interesting chats about answering the question. I just want to kind of run through them so that everybody knows. Because some people have said initially we had the comment about staff capacity, but then there were a number of comments suggesting that advocate safety was an issue or a concern, and concern that advocates would be contacted by the abuser's family or friends or something like that. And somebody responded, somebody named Carmen responded from a rural area in Colorado and said she'd been doing it for 16 years and had never had an advocate threatened in that way. So she didn't think that, because I would think that'd be more likely to be a problem in a rural community where everybody knows everybody else and they know who you are and what you're doing. Laura also brought up the lack of a CCR, lack of a cooperative law enforcement, or identifying the perpetrator as the victim. And if that's happening a lot, you know, that's something that you'd have to be aware of if you were going to be contacting victims. I think we'll be talking a little bit about that later on. But these are all really valid concerns for people to have.
Right, right. And, you know, there's a list of them here, too. And one of the things you can do is, if, as you think about some of these things, you can always contact me or Stephanie or Kathleen to talk about, you know, the reasons why or, you know, how they overcame some of those obstacles or how they thought about it. And so, but generally what we see is that those objections or those obstacles to providing it are overcome by the very real needs that are listed here about why to do it, what's the philosophy and rationale behind it. And Kathleen, do you have anything, you know, you mentioned that there had been this kind of, oh, we don't reach out, they come to us, and you mentioned something about the fact that you decided upon looking at it. Was there anything in particular that was most salient to you in terms of saying, okay, we gotta figure this out, we can't just rest on our old philosophical assumptions, this is a new way of thinking about it?
I think most prevalent was hearing the stories of women's experience when they did not get information about advocacy or have that contact, and just how awful that was for them to sit with the fears and the uncertainty and to want to begin to figure out how to make that better for women in our community.
Right. I think that, I mean, we'll slip ahead here, and that's the risk piece that you talk about it, you know, that she's got a lot of risks that she's facing as a result of the intervention, and somebody chatted in one of the more, I think, egregious risks, which is the victim themselves may be arrested, and so doing the advocacy initiated response is there's a piece of it where you're providing the advocacy to that victim in an ongoing battering relationship. So in that situation, you would be directed to go and provide advocacy to the victim defendant who's in jail. So that's a huge risk. And Stephanie, anything on the risk component that you would like to add?
Well, there are lots and lots of risks that battered women face, and those of us who are involved in intervention like to think that everything we're doing is helpful, but sometimes there are what you call intervention-associated risks, and one of them, of course, being that the wrong person gets arrested. But other things can happen, you know, like the police could be making a referral to child protection. Once the system is involved, there's all sorts of things that are out of the victim's control. Maybe she didn't call the police. Maybe she never initiated this, and somehow police got called, and there's a million different things that are involved in the processing of a criminal case, and none of it was perhaps anything she wanted anything to do with, and it's pretty overwhelming. And the advantage of having an advocate talking to such a victim is that the advocate should have a pretty solid knowledge of how the system works in that particular community, and not just how it works, but, you know, who the players are and who's likely to be helpful and who's likely to be maybe not so helpful, and when offer to go with women to different things that they might have to do, like attending hearings and so forth. And so it can, I really think that there's a lot involved in getting, if you've been doing this for a while, you think, well, misdemeanor, it's really not such a big deal. It's a mighty big deal to somebody who's never encountered the criminal legal system in that way before.
Yeah, you know, one of the things I was thinking as you're talking, Stephanie, is that an unintended positive consequence of doing advocacy intervention, advocacy initiated response, is that it makes the advocate smarter, too. You know, that you, if you're not there, you don't know all the things that are going on. And, in fact, you may assume that what's going on, you know, your source of information about that may be coming from the, let's say, law enforcement themselves, who may have a different interpretation about what's going on. And law enforcement themselves may not know that all these things are happening to the victim as a result of their intervention. For example, when I was just recently in Tillamook, and Kathleen, you can add in here, but I think they were kind of surprised to understand what was the impact of her contacting the officer or law enforcement for assistance, that she's, I can't think of another victim of a crime who may accrue more negative consequences as a result of calling for help. I mean, she may lose her children, she may be turned in on a warrant, she may lose her home. I mean, in Tillamook at this point, there may be an automatic, generally a no contact order put into place. And in some parts of Oregon, there's no way that contact order can be lifted. In Tillamook, you can, the woman can go talk to the advocate for an hour or so, and then it can be lifted. But still, it can be a no, there can be a, the guy could maybe bail out before he even gets to the jail. A no contact order is put in place, and it may be in place till the first appearance, which can occur as much as six weeks later. And Kathleen, it seems to me that in that room where we're all talking about what happened to the victim in this process, that the systems people really got on board for saying, well, this isn't what we wanted to happen, right? We didn't want this to have more punitive impact on the victim than on the perpetrator. Did you get
yes.
that sense, Sue?
Yes, very much so. And it, you know, it has started some other conversations of change in our community, and we've already established liaisons between the departments who will really start looking at, as we implement this and we're getting more information, where people will have a formal system within the work to begin to try to problem solve these issues. So.
Right. And I think, you know, one of the things that I think the advocacy initiated response does is it puts a woman more in the driver's seat in terms of what are our efforts as an advocacy or a CC advocacy program or a CCR in the community. If we are about victim safety, if that's our primary objective, well, then this is a way to find out and to walk alongside of her and then to understand what is the impact of our joint and individual interventions. Is that something you see as well, too, Stephanie, in your work?
Oh, yeah.
Issue?
Oh, yeah. And the other thing is you get the ability not just to walk alongside her and have things happen to her, but what I always thought was the most fun as an advocate was to know that something different happened because the advocacy had occurred, because what we typically did was communicated to the court what the victim's wishes were regarding different possible choices that could be made, for example, about whether or not to issue a no contact order. So if you knew that something typically is going to happen, if no, you know, because you can, if you've been in court and you've watched and there's no victim there and no input, you can see what happens as a, on a routine basis. So you can tell women, this is, if you don't do anything, this is what's likely to happen. And he, you know, in, where I worked, it usually meant the guy would be in jail until the next day. He'd have an arraignment, and he'd be released with probably with minimal bail. So you could convey to the court, if she wants, that for example, she's filing an order for protection in the morning, and she wants him served before he's released from jail. Or that perhaps, you know, if he pleads guilty, what she's really interested in is having him get some kind of counseling. I mean, there's a lot you can talk about with women, and you can, and things will happen in court differently than how they would happen if there's no input.
Right. Very good. You know, for me too, I'm really sensitive to wanting to make sure that we don't establish hierarchies of who has worth in terms of, you know, the systems in which we operate. You know, the woman in a domestic violence situation comes from a position where she's being controlled by her partner, right? And so a lot of times what we see is the community wants us to get with these women and tell her how to think about this. You know, meet you as advocates, you meet with her and you tell her that she's being battered and you give her an hour lecture and then maybe we'll lift the contact order. But in reality, I mean, there's going to be, this makes it more of a give and take. We'll tell you what we know and you tell us how this is working for you. And we'll work together to make some changes, ideally. And that's, of course, where you come into saying, okay, let's solve this together. I'm going to skip over a couple of slides here, and so you'll have those slides. If there's questions that you have about them, feel free to contact us about it. But I wanted to get to some of the nuts and bolts about what's going on here. So let's talk about this first things first. And this is, we're going to walk through some of these steps here. Stephanie,
yes?
Talk to me about this. Is this pretty much how you think of it? The initial call comes from law enforcement. You mentioned in Baltimore, law enforcement can call from the scene and
mm-hmm.
use their own phone and hand it to the victim.
Is yeah,
that
and actually,
practice? That makes
well,
sense.
Actually, that's, I mean, that's how they do it with the lethality assessment programs. But that's what they do for the high-risk cases, you know, where somebody's scoring on a really high lethality scale. And my guess, I don't know this for sure, but my guess is that those phone calls are relatively brief. And you really need a longer phone call when the cops have cleared the scene. I always called... I was usually calling shortly after, you know, or we had people call when we used volunteers when I worked in a rural county. The volunteers called after the police left, and they talked to the woman about what was going on and so forth. And then they would tell her because they didn't get enough calls, and they weren't as familiar with the court scene. So they would tell her that I would call in the morning. So in the morning, I would call back and say, well, I know that Nancy talked to you last night, and I would talk more about what's going to happen in court, because the volunteers told me that they just didn't feel comfortable providing that information when it wasn't something from their experience. Mm-hmm. So what they did was basically more of a, you know, supportive call. And then they said that the questions you're having are going to be answered by Stephanie in the morning. So I would call then, and interestingly, of course, a lot of women would say that they weren't pressing charges,
mm-hmm.
And so I spent a lot of time explaining to people that they weren't pressing charges, and yet charges were being pressed because because of how the laws had changed. But the contradiction there, of course, is that their cooperation would be needed if they wanted prosecution to actually be successful. So some of those things about, like women would say oftentimes that they wanted the charges dismissed. And I know people that would just convey to the court, she wants the charges dismissed. But it's one thing to just take that at face value. It turned out if you say, talk to me a little bit about that, why do you want the charges dismissed, you discover very quickly that women usually thought he wasn't going to get out of jail or that he was going to serve some lengthy period of time, mm-hmm. and that the consequences were going to be really, really dire. And in the communities I worked in, it was highly unlikely that there'd be much of a jail sentence. The bigger problem was that if the woman wanted him to be kept in jail, he probably wouldn't. And then the court would be viewing, I mean, they'd say, well, he got arrested, and that's enough, but if he does it again, then I want to see it prosecuted. And what they didn't know was that from the court's point of view, the next time would be the first time if this case mm-hmm. got dismissed. And so they'd treat it, if you thought you were going to get a severe consequence, it wouldn't happen for a first offense. Mm-hmm. And it wouldn't be viewed as a second offense if it had been dismissed outright as the first time. So all of those explanations about how do things really work. You know, and the other thing people would say sometimes is really interesting, because we discovered that we would be talking to the women, and then the prosecutors would call them, and the prosecutors would say to us, how come when you talk to her, she wants X, Y, Z, and then when I talk to her, she wants the case dismissed? And then we listened in on what they were talking to the women about, and they were talking to them about appearing as a witness to the trial. In a jurisdiction where trials were so rare, it was so unlikely that it would ever happen, because virtually everything was getting settled. And so they were scaring her. They were scaring her with the idea that she was going to have to testify in a trial. And so they got very little cooperation.
Yes,
now,
that's a good point. They were being discouraged subtly and not so subtly. And so some of what you talk about is not going to happen on the hotline call. I would add that in addition to support, however, it's good to have your hotline advocate equipped with frequently asked questions about maybe what's next in the court process, you know.
You know what I've always wanted?
Is she going to be let out of jail, and what, you know, does she have to go to court? Because that kind of question. And so I want to keep moving here.
I really think hotline advocates should spend a little time observing arraignment court, because that's probably the most frequent. I mean, so they know what it looks like and can say, you know, this is what happens. No case takes more than 3 minutes, for example.
Yeah, and so Kathleen, you're going to be splitting your duties up here too between the hotline advocate and then the next day your advocate. You don't call them legal advocates. Everybody does this function in your office, but you have the beauty of working with a very good victim witness program. So some of these things you're going to be sorting out amongst you. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, a little bit. We have only begun to talk, have a conversation about it, but we do plan to really sort that out, make it very clear what each of our roles will be. Our office will be making that first call and advising, getting information about exactly what to expect from the Victims Assistance Program the next day and ongoing. And then we will both potentially support people through the court process, but in different roles. So.
Yeah, and it's an interesting opportunity for the victim, the court advocates, and the community-based advocates to put their heads together and say, okay, what's our distinct roles here relative to a case, and mm-hmm. how can we collaborate? In some places it gets a little, I hate to say it, but sometimes you can get a little competitive as opposed to collaborative. So you've got an ideal situation where your victim witness person is just like all on board for getting as that victim as much advocacy as she can get from every possible resource. And so we'll be working with you and me to put together a protocol that says, here's how we work together on a case. And so I'm looking forward to that. But and some of these duties, I mean, we have sample procedures, protocols, forms, et cetera, for advocacy programs. And it looks like there's a bunch of people online who are doing these advocacy-initiated responses as well. So to that end, you know, anything that you have in your possession that outlines what you do as an advocacy program and also the agreement that you have with your law enforcement program, that can be something that might be of use to other programs on the line who are just getting started. So, to that end, it's recommended that there be a protocol in place, that you do a written agreement with your police department, law enforcement agency. And Kathleen, you mentioned that's some of what you're involved in doing right now, right?
Yes, after working with you, Rose, we've had it two meetings since then, actually, to look at the protocol. Discuss a few of the modifications to it, and it's now with our county attorney for review. So we're moving forward pretty quickly in creating that protocol. And then we will bring it to you to see if it gets your input as well, if you're willing.
So anytime, you know, there was one person who mentioned a difficult situation with their law enforcement, and obviously you're going to need to be able to negotiate with them about making sure that their law enforcement agencies contact you. But be sure that what you do, you will put into writing so that it's clear that this is the agreement. And we have sample protocols on our website that you can take a look at to get some information from and adapt them to your own community. And that's what Kathleen is talking about, starting out with this what we call a sample working agreement. Why replicate the wheel if there's something already in place? Is this is what's being done in other parts of the country too? Stephanie, I know you worked with Baltimore. Did they get a protocol too that established what both entities would be doing, law enforcement and advocacy programs?
Yeah, they did. This was quite a while ago, but now they're before they actually had were doing the lethality assessment program, but it was kind of in the laying the groundwork for it, and they really hadn't had a very good relationship with that particular program, hadn't had a good relationship with the police, and sometimes there's just not much trust. And but what we're finding across the country is that as police are doing these lethality assessments and connecting women with advocates, they're gaining more respect for what advocates are doing, because they didn't know anything about it before.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think, and they're in part of the training for using the lethality assessment model includes explanation of the benefits of having advocacy programs involved in women's lives. And probably like a lot of folks, they might have just thought that, you know, it was either shelter or not shelter. And there's many, many other things that advocates do, and they don't really want to be doing advocacy themselves. I mean, they've got their job as a cop is to collect evidence and you know, make the breasts and do the, you know, do all these various things. And the added difficulty of they don't know themselves what's going to happen next. I mean, like what most people were telling women where I worked, when they wanted to know something about the charge, they would say, it's a misdemeanor, 90 days in jail. Well, that could have been why so many women thought that 90 days in jail was inevitable, when in fact the reality was it was highly unlikely.
Right,
I mean, there are other places, of course, where you might know that the response is going to be pretty awful.
Right,
and
right.
I mean, you want to be able to give some accurate picture of what's going on. Another thing we found out in Carver County was that police officers like to get some feedback about what happened, because sometimes they really did care, and they wanted to know, did he get prosecuted? They didn't know the outcomes of most of the cases. So
right.
That's
Stephanie,
you
sound a little cynical. You say some of the time. I think that over time we've seen more and more. we started out thinking back in the early 80s they didn't care, and then we realized that it was more about they didn't have the tools they needed to do the job that needed to be done there, right?
Well, right, right. And so I started, I would invite cops to contact me later, and I'd say I'd be happy to share information with you. Obviously, I couldn't share, confidential information, but the outcome of the case is a matter of public record.
Right,
so.
Right. Yes. So let's talk a little bit about, I mean, I want to go over this real quickly, because what the officer is going to do at the scene, which probably, I think here's another good reason to be interested in being able to make this connection with advocates, is because all they got to do is let her know that an advocate is going to be contacting them, and that the victim doesn't have to talk to the advocate if she doesn't want to. In some places, you know, officers feel like, well, I'm not a good advocate. I don't know how to talk about this stuff. So they know that piece is being taken care of. And then, of course, what you're going to have the officer do is get some phone numbers where she can be reached now and then later. And then the contact will be made. Then the officer will make the contact with the advocacy program. And then it becomes the advocacy program's job to have the procedures in place, the forms and the training for the hotline and the on-call advocate, the next day advocate, and then I have the institutional advocate or the CCR coordinator. And I just want to say at this particular juncture that what you find out, and again, this is a two-way street, you're providing them with the information that you know about the system, but you're also getting information from them about the impact of that system on their lives. So that's a piece that's of great interest to the CCR. You know, if we think we're doing something that protects her and she's safer as a result, and in reality, it's making her homeless, impoverished, and she loses her children, well, that's, you know, that's something that we need to be aware of and think about when we design our interventions. And then, of course, I got a role for the supervisor, too, to make sure you're always looking at what's going on and are we doing a good job, what's out there in the broader community in terms of how to respond. And I just wanted to go through those quickly because I wanted to spend the last time that we have together for you, Stephanie, and Kathleen, to talk about this whole concept of working with the identified victim in an individual incident versus working with the victim in an ongoing battering relationship who may now be arrested. So that's a particularly complicated issue, Stephanie, and I know that people are grappling with this all over the country. And so tell us a little bit about this Northwest Network and what they have to provide on this, in this question.
The Northwest Network is a group that has had, because they're working with bisexual, trans, and lesbian survivors of abuse, they're very acutely aware that they cannot, you know, when a victim is in front of them or presenting herself or himself as a victim, you can't just use gender to say, to determine who's the victim. So they've had to really do some deep analysis of what is it that, you know, how do you determine? How do you know that you're talking to the victim? And so they have, they've done some webinars and trainings on this. And anybody who's got, who's working in a jurisdiction where there's a lot of women getting arrested, would benefit from looking at how to, you know, how to talk, because then you might be expected to be contacting, men who were abusers because the wrong person was arrested. And you could get a lot of guidance from this program because they've figured out ways of talking to people about, you know, determining not just, you know, like, are you afraid? And what are you afraid of? And are you, do you feel dread? You know, a conversation with somebody can really uncover what's going on. And if you've got a same-sex couple, the victim is going to sound like the victim, and just like people that you're used to talking with. It's not at all unusual. I mean, I've been doing this work for many, many, many years, and just recently, I was contacted by a guy who it's the first time I've ever talk to a male victim in a heterosexual relationship, and he was very fearful of things that he thought his partner could do in the court system, and so on and so forth. And he was pretty overwhelmed. He wasn't afraid of her use of physical violence, although she had been physically abusive with him, but that wasn't what he was afraid of. He was afraid of her having the upper hand in a court situation. He was afraid of her.
Yeah, and so, I mean, I think the biggest problem we're facing and seeing out there, and this is one of the things that people will be unable to have a firsthand knowledge of, is that we're seeing the problem is more about not being able to identify when a victim is using force or self-defense or resistance in a physical sense and gets arrested in an ongoing, you know, somebody who's, let's say, we think of as a battered woman. And, I mean, so there's information to be had from looking at these kinds of things. Now, Kathleen, in your jurisdiction, one of the things that people were talking about was that that we could start with using those risk questions, right? That a lot of that will get to the problem.
Yes, I think everyone in the room was really, we had our district attorney, our victim's assistants, law enforcement, and everyone was just really committed to beginning to ask these risk questions from the beginning, from the 911 call, and throughout the process. So we'll be looking at how we might be able to do that.
Right. Because there's another piece here, too. I mean, Northwest is a good way of looking at, you know, how can we determine who we're talking to here and how can we figure out who does what to whom with what impact. But there's also the question of how do you talk in your community about, okay, our eligibility guidelines. And this was a place where the victim witnesses and the advocacy program can work together really closely because the victim witness people are going to be providing advocacy to that identified victim in this particular incident, whereas the community-based advocates, and this is something that Barbara said in your jurisdiction, you know, Kathleen, was that it bothers her when she knows that the person in jail probably is the ongoing victim. but she can't provide advocacy to her. So she was happy that you would be going and meeting with that victim in jail. So I wanted to ask people in the chat to, if you have worked out some of these issues about eligibility criteria or when, how do you figure and how do you make assessments about who gets the advocacy in a situation that's a little blurry, and if you have something like that, if you would list yourselves as being potential resources that we could call upon to get some of what you've done in this regard, that would be great. And now I wanted to move to the next piece, and this is something I think that Kathleen, you can talk about, because you've done just an excellent job in your community in this regard. So tell us a little bit about how you got buy-in from your law enforcement people.
I think it just started with what we all know to do, which is just to begin to meet with people and talk about that, what's being done and what the outcomes are showing, and talk about the reasons why, what might be something that would be challenging for them. And so it was just a lot of conversations, a lot of meetings, talking about how our mutual goals and how this could help us meet them. So building some understanding, and then, of course, having you come to provide technical assistance really moved the process along. But all of those things that were found in the studies that we could bring forward, and just having frank conversations about what people's fears or concerns were, and beginning to do that earlier on, I think is helpful. And it does seem as though that buy-in is happening. It's not with every law enforcement agency in our county, so we are starting with those who are most interested in, hoping that others will join us.
Right, right. And did it help to come forward with a concrete sort of, let's do this, let's take a look at this, what does this protocol look like to you?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So super. So, you know, we are getting towards the end here of our conversation, and I wanted, Stephanie, if you had any closing comments, and then Kathleen, and then I know Ashley wants to come in and say a few words, and that will be it for today. And before I hand it over to you, Stephanie and Kathleen, I just wanted to say you'll be seeing a slide at the end, and do feel free to contact me, and Stephanie's on the list too, and Kathleen, if you have any questions. And I'd also love to hear from you if you have resources and what you've done in your community to work things out. So, so great. So, Stephanie, any goodbye thoughts?
Oh, just that I'm really happy to hear that so many more people are beginning to think about doing this, because I think it's a really, really great way to connect with advocates. And we haven't talked about this at all, but I also think it's important for people in their communities to, you know, when women are thinking that they should just have nothing to do with the criminal process, if they've got children, that criminal process might be the only way to establish that there's been domestic violence, and it could make a difference later on in a family court case. So it's something that victims should be aware of, what their family courts are, victim advocates should be aware of what the family courts are doing, and talking to women about that stuff right away, because if she's not thinking about separating at the time when you're talking with her, she should start being aware that down the road it could make a difference.
Oh, that's such a good point. I'm glad you got that in there. Thank you, Stephanie, for your excellent experience and wisdom on all these topics. And Kathleen, any closing thoughts?
Well, I would just say I'm really excited to see some of the comments that are coming in and all the work that's being done. This is really new to us, so it's going to be great to be learning from all those people who have gotten further along in the process, and I appreciated being on this call and sharing the very beginning stages of this effort. So thank you for letting me be on the call.
Yeah, you're at the beginning, but man, your community is ready to rock, which is to your credit. So I think it's going to be like wildfire. So I'm happy about that. And Ashley, you have anything in closing? Ashley, there? Is she there? Okay, well, I know she just wanted to say she wanted you to join us next month, and you'll be getting information about that. And then she wanted to thank us speakers today for such an excellent job. She thinks we're all brilliant. She can't say enough about it. So, and she looks forward to connecting with all of you again next month, and goodbye. So thank you, everybody. Thanks for your work. Bye-bye.
This officially ends the call. You may now disconnect the lines.